The case before us is MDC Holdings versus the Town of Parker. The petitioner may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. Leo Pomerantz, bar number 24741. We ask the petitioner, MDC Holdings, which is in Colorado, which I will refer to collectively as Richmond. The court granted certiorari on two issues. To paraphrase, first is whether letters issued by the town's outside legal counsel on February 22, 2006 constituted final decisions as contemplated by section 29-2-106.1 of the Colorado Revised Statutes, which I'll refer to as the uniform statute as we have in our briefs. The second issue for which the court granted cert is related to whether the town should be permitted to deny Richmond further appeal rights despite municipal code provisions that conflicted with the uniform statute and despite the town's contemporaneous representations to Richmond concerning the finality of the disputed letters. Now, the towns devote a majority of their answer brief to a third issue that was not part of the court's order granting cert, namely whether Richmond failed to exhaust its administrative remedies by declining to participate in a second formal hearing mandated by each of the town's municipal codes. I'd like to begin by briefly summarizing the uniform statute, including this court's prior jurisprudence concerning the statute. We believe that's necessary to put all of the disputed issues into their proper context. Then I'll address the finality issues for which the court granted cert. And lastly, I'll turn to the exhaustion claims made by the towns in their brief. The Colorado legislature enacted the uniform statute in 1985. As stated in the statute's opening paragraph, it arose from a recognition that the resolution of local sales and use tax disputes was a matter of statewide concern. Based upon that recognition, the paragraph concludes by saying, and I quote, that the procedure set forth in this section shall be applied uniformly throughout the state.
You're really arguing a preemption issue, are you not, that the state has set forth the procedures and actually it's what is it, the Board of Assessment Appeals? What is the board, the state board, that, remind me, that makes the decision?
When an appeal is filed of a sales and use tax assessment, or there's a protest of a refund, as is the case here, the appeal is first to the municipal jurisdiction itself, and an informal hearing must be held by that local government first. Thereafter, the appeal is either to the Department of Revenue or to district court at the taxpayer's election. But yes, we are arguing a preemption issue that this statute, the Uniform Statute 29-2-106.1, prescribes rules that are binding on all the local governments, and that they trump any local government administrative position provisions that are in conflict. That's what this court said in Walgreens.
Okay, but there is an election there, and it's the director of the Department of Revenue. That's an alternative. Or the district court, under what kind of procedure? The state... Not 106, this state statute.
106.
It would be.
So under subpart 3 of 106.1, the taxpayer can appeal to the executive director of the Department of Revenue, or under subpart 8 of the Uniform Statute, the taxpayer can appeal directly to the district court. In either case, it's a de novo review.
Yeah, I think you were getting, you were talking cross purposes. I think, Justice Houser, you're referring to Rule 106, and you're referring to statutory section 106.
106A4, is that what you're referring to? Right, that's not prescribed anywhere in the uniform statute.
Okay, that's
I really did have trouble with the briefs trying to get what your ultimate position is. So would you just state it one more time? Your position is you don't have to go through this extra hoop that the cities want. In fact, it's preempted by the state statute.
That's right.
So I'm asking you what the state statute provides.
Okay, the state statute.
And why it's a preemption.
Okay. The state statute says that the first step in any appeal is an informal hearing. It says that any local government can have only one hearing, and it says that that hearing must be informal in nature. Okay. After that hearing, if the local government issues a final decision, that's the term that's used in the uniform statute, then the taxpayer has 30 days from receipt of that final decision to take that appeal, again, either to the district court or to the Department of Revenue. If after that informal hearing that's conducted at the local government level, there is no final decision issued within 90 days, and we're talking 90 days from the date the request for the hearing is filed by the taxpayer, then at that 90th day, according to the uniform statute, the taxpayer has exhausted its local remedies. And at that point, a 30-day clock starts on the appeal to the district court or to the Department of Revenue. So our position is we timely requested an informal hearing. We had an informal hearing. We thereafter waited for the towns to issue final decisions. Those final decisions never came. So we followed the uniform statute's definition of when exhaustion of local remedies takes place, when there is no final decision issued by the local government. And the uniform statute says that exhaustion takes place after 90 days. We waited the 90 days, then a 30-day.
So something more than a letter from council is required, some kind of decision by the, what part of the city has to make the decision?
Well, we would say it has to come from the hearing officer, which was the finance director of each of the towns.
Who presides over the voluntary proceeding.
Presided over the informal hearing that was held, correct?
Right.
Now, in this case, far from getting a decision from the hearing officer itself that described itself in some fashion that could be construed as a final decision, perhaps using such terms as decision, determination, ruling, what we got was a letter from outside counsel for the town that specifically said that, in the town's view, the matters weren't even ripe for final decisions.
So, well, that was because of their extra code addition to procedure, which you're saying is preempted. Isn't that your position?
That's exactly right.
So really what you're asking us for is to simply say that that is an invalid extra step.
Right.
That's in their code.
Precisely. That was addressed by this court in Walgreen, actually, where Denver tried to force taxpayers into a single hearing, a formal hearing. And the court said that in instances where there is a conflict between the uniform statute and the local administrative provisions, the state statute trumps, and any local provisions to the contrary are rendered inoperative. In other words, that the taxpayer doesn't need to follow those conflicting local government provisions. So that was the position that we found ourselves in here. We were faced with a situation where, while the uniform statute prescribes a single informal hearing, town's code provided for two hearings, an informal hearing followed by a mandatory formal hearing, whereas the uniform statute allows the taxpayer to elect one of two different procedures for appeal, either to the district court or to the executive director of the Department of Revenue. The code said you get only one right of appeal, to district court, whereas the uniform statute said you get a de novo right of appeal, whichever appeal route you choose. The town's code said you don't get de novo review. You get review only under CRCP 106A4, based upon the record established below. That's why we didn't choose to go into that formal hearing, because it wasn't permitted by the uniform.
And it changes the burden of proof, basically. I mean, the burden of review, instead of arbitrary and capricious review, it's de novo. Of course, I don't understand why the legislature would use an alternative of the district court or the director, but if that's what they did, they did.
But you're absolutely right. I mean, there's a dramatic difference. If we go to a formal hearing, and we've got very restrictive rights of appeal. We've got to present all of our evidence at the local government level. If we follow the uniform statute, we get de novo appeal, whichever appeal route we choose.
Do we have any information in the record about when these town ordinances were enacted?
I don't recall. I think I could probably get you that answer quite quickly here.
Well, I don't need to take up your time. You can supply that to me later.
Yeah, I think they've been in place for quite a long period of time.
Well, one, looking at the code version of the statute, it says that Section 3 was enacted about 10 years later. I don't think that there was any discussion about that. Is that correct?
I'm talking about Part 3 of this.
The state statute.
I don't believe that's the case. I thought all of the material provisions of the uniform statute, I thought, went into effect in 1985.
Okay.
Because I think they were in effect when the court decided Walgreen in 1991.
Well, perhaps that's something else you could check. At the tag end of the statute, it says Section 3 enacted 1996.
Section 3 is the provision that allows the appeal to the executive director.
Right.
I could be wrong, but I think in the Walgreen decision, I think the court made reference to that right to appeal to the executive director, although in that case, the taxpayer, I believe, chose to appeal directly into district court for de novo review.
Mr. Pomeranz, concerning your preemption argument, is your argument that the state statute sets forth a procedure and it controls and we shouldn't look to the city code? Or is it instead that we should try to reconcile, but it's not reconcilable?
I think the taxpayer is obligated to follow any local government procedures to the extent that they're consistent with the state statute. There are certain elements of the appeal process that aren't specifically prescribed in the state statute, and taxpayers should follow the provisions in the local ordinances. For example, as discussed in the recent United Airlines case, the issue had to do with whether or not the taxpayer had properly followed the time period set forth by the local government for initiating the first appeal, the 20-day period. We'd be obligated to follow the local government procedures to the extent they're not in conflict with the state statute. In this case, however, there are clearly parts of the review process within these two towns that were irreconcilable.
But let me ask the other question, because you've gone through the several, I think, 3 points at least, or maybe there's a little bit more, where there are, in your view, irreconcilable differences. Could you explain to me to what extent the town's code, the procedure in the town's code, is consistent with the statute and must be followed?
Right. It was consistent to the extent that it permitted taxpayers to request an informal hearing. That informal hearing is addressed in the uniform statute, in section 2 of the uniform statute. That was perfectly permissible for the local government to offer that to taxpayers. That's what Richmond, in this case, elected to do. They asked for that informal hearing. We attended that informal hearing. The hearing was held. Thereafter, all the provisions in the town's codes were in conflict. That is, critically, they required the taxpayer at that point, within 15 days of the informal hearing, to request a formal hearing. Okay, so we didn't do that, again, under the guidance of Walgreen. Instead, what we did is we then reverted to the uniform statute, and we waited for the second event that's required for the taxpayer to exhaust its local remedies. And what's critical here is that the uniform statute defines exhaustion of local remedies. It tells us when a taxpayer has exhausted local remedies sufficient that they can take their next appeal. It requires two things. It requires participating in an informal hearing, and second, getting a final decision. So after our informal hearing, that's what we did. We waited for that final decision, and it never came. The decision of the Court of Appeals was that this letter that we got from outside legal counsel for the towns on February 22nd amounted to a final decision, and so that our 30-day window on an appeal began to run at that point, not at the 90-day mark, which is what we considered.
No, but counsel is not the authority that makes the decision, right? I mean, that's the point.
Well, that's certainly our view.
Right. Well, I mean, how could it be otherwise? I don't understand it, especially when you read that letter. It sounds like advice. We're going to take this position. We're going to take that position. It doesn't say this is a final decision.
We absolutely agree with you. It was a letter from an advocate for the towns. It bore no indication that it was a final decision, and to the contrary, it told us that the matters were not ripe for final.
Well, plus, the decision maker can't delegate that authority to the attorney. Can a decision maker do that?
We don't believe so. And if there were any doubt about how that February 22nd letter should be construed, we tried to eliminate that doubt by sending a letter 2 days later, on February 24th, saying, if you continue to disagree with our position, please give us final decision so that we can immediately commence our further appeals. Those are, I think, exhibits 15 and 16 in the stipulated exhibit binder. So we gave them an opportunity to clarify. If they thought the February 22nd letter was, in fact, a final decision, they could have said at that point, we're not going to issue a final decision because you already got those 2 days ago. I think the obvious point is they didn't say that because they didn't believe the February 22nd letters were final decisions when they were issued. In fact, they were telling us that we weren't going to get anything in the nature of a final ruling from the towns until we asked for and participated in second formal hearings.
And who under their procedure would preside over that formal hearing? Who would be the decision maker? Is it a different person than the person that did the informal hearing or of informal procedure?
I believe the codes provide for the finance director to conduct that hearing, but it could be a delegee of the finance director. But the towns choose the hearing officer. It's not some independent tribunal that conducts that hearing, which, from our perspective, is another reason why the uniform statute tells us that the hearing at the local level should be informal, because the taxpayer shouldn't be required to make a record that's binding for future appeals before a hearing officer that's not independent, that's chosen by the taxing official.
Just for us, you may have answered my question, I'm not entirely sure, so let me ask it anyway. And that is, if I understand it, the town's argument, or one of their arguments, is that the informal procedure isn't really an informal procedure at all, that's just misnamed, that it's the formal procedure in the town code that is consistent with the informal procedure in the statute. And could you, getting over for a minute the nomenclature that's actually used, just passing that, could you explain to me why that isn't the case, why it is that their formal procedure could not in fact be the statutory informal procedure?
Right, well, getting past the labels.
Right, and I don't want to discount that. I just want to ask you something different.
The formal hearing is a formal hearing not just by label. It's in substance, it's a formal hearing. The code provision says that the taxpayer must make their record in that formal hearing. And from the formal hearing, the next statute says that the taxpayer has to appeal into district court under CRCP 106A4. So it looks like any other formal hearing you might expect, a hearing in which the taxpayer is required to make their record, present all their evidence, and then they're going to be bound by that record going forward. So it wasn't just perhaps a misuse of names. This was not an informal hearing.
May I follow up on that just one second? And that's just the flip side of that, though. But it seemed to me your opponents are arguing that what you're calling the informal hearing wasn't a hearing at all, and therefore didn't oblige them to make any kind of a final ruling, even under the state statute, and therefore you had not yet exhausted your state remedies, even under your theory. Could you address that?
Yes. Well, I mean, the code provisions call it an informal hearing. I mean, that's what we asked for. We were following our request. We were told, okay, here's the date for your hearing. We showed up for the hearing. We had every reason to believe, based upon the codes and the response to our hearing request, that the meeting that we had with the towns was, in fact, that informal hearing. May I just, to the issue of exhaustion, if it is true, if you could agree with the towns far enough to say we never even had an informal hearing, then neither of the two exhaustion events took place under the uniform statute. That is, we neither had an informal hearing nor got a final decision, in which case, again, the 90-day rule comes into play. After 90 days without getting both, we've exhausted.
Well, maybe. This ties in very closely, it seems to me, with the sort of preemption-related argument here. And maybe I'm misunderstanding it, but it seems to me, as a procedural matter, the towns seem to be arguing they were not at a position in which a judgment, a final order was required, and therefore the state statutes dealing with the failure of them to issue a final order are not applicable. And instead, it seemed to me, and maybe you could address this aspect of it, this angle, it seemed to me they were arguing that procedurally, if you were not going to comply with the town's procedure on the grounds that it was preempted or not allowed by the state statute, that you had an obligation to raise that in the form of a declaratory judgment or something else, rather than simply not exhausting the remedies they provided, appealing that, and claiming that those remedies or those procedures were were preempted by state statute anyway. I may have missed their argument too, but if you could address that problem.
Sure. I believe the Walgreen decision from this court, which is consistent with many prior decisions, says that when you have matter of statewide concern, and there are conflicts between state law and municipal code provisions, that the municipal code provisions are rendered inoperative to the extent of the conflict. That is, you are not obligated to file a declaratory judgment action. You might have the right to do so, but you're not obligated to do so. So I think that's what Walgreens says, additional cases we haven't cited in our briefs from this court, a national advertising case from 1988, the Thornton case from 1978. There are many cases that say when you have this conflict between state law and local law on a matter of statewide concern, which is what the uniform statute says this is, and what this court agreed it was in the Walgreens decision, that just the taxpayer is only obligated to follow the state law, because the state law supersedes any local provisions. Does that answer your question?
Well, it does. So I take it what you're saying is there is no obligation then on your part to have any judicial determination that these procedures set out by the towns are not applicable or not enforceable, but rather if, as it turns out, ultimately you can show that they are inconsistent with and, or let's say, preempted by the state statute, then you just never had to comply with them in the first place. Is that right?
That's right. That's absolutely right. But I just want to emphasize that we complied with the code provisions to the extent that they were consistent with the uniform statute. We asked for the informal hearing. We participated in the informal hearing. We waited for the final decision.
And if I can only say there, it seems to me there at least in terms of your response to me and Justice Martinez, you're relying a fair amount, maybe entirely, on the nomenclature, an informal hearing, that the state refers to an informal hearing and the town's ordinances do as well. But I thought the town was arguing, yes, but we're passing each other in the night with regard to what an informal hearing is. And in effect, what happened down in the town was simply a settlement conference or something to that effect and wouldn't meet the state standards for what they contemplate for an informal hearing. Does that seem right?
Well, I have two responses. The first is I think the taxpayer has the right to trust in the terms that are used by local government. That is, if we see in a code provision that it says informal hearing, we have a right to treat it as an informal hearing. If we see something that's referred to as a formal hearing, we have every right to believe it's a formal hearing and not really an informal hearing. Okay, so that's number one. Number two is I think it wasn't just labels. It was really in substance. These were first an informal and a formal. So the informal hearing, I believe in the code provision, it talks about being conducted in any manner that the parties choose to. It's described as an informal discussion between the parties with an aim towards settling the dispute. Okay, that's an informal hearing in our view, in substance. Formal hearing, again, in substance, but described as a formal hearing, requires the taxpayer to make a record. That's formal. That, I don't know how you can construe a hearing where the taxpayer is obligated to make a record as an informal hearing. That's quite formal. It's your last opportunity to make your record.
Mr. Pomerantz, pertinent to your statement earlier that you requested an informal hearing, and I think implicit was, you know, pursuant to statute, and then this is the process that they provided. And that was pertinent to your argument that, therefore, you've either exhausted, or if that's not exhaustion because that wasn't an informal hearing, then you're still exhausted because they didn't get the hearing. So pertinent to that, tell me about what specifically you requested. I mean, what was the form of that request? Does it support the notion that you were requested, the terminology you were using was statutory terminology, or does it instead support the argument that I guess the city is making that you were requesting a informal code hearing, which is actually not a hearing at all, or is it neutral?
Right. I think the answer is found in the exhibit binder. It's 7 and 8. And in each case, everything was done in duplicate because there were two different towns. So 7 and 8 are two different hearing requests, one for each of the towns. The language is essentially identical. And they start off by saying, the taxpayers hereby request an informal hearing in the town of Parker's December 22nd, denial of the company's claim for refund. The request is made in accordance with CRS 29-2-106.12C, that's the uniform statute, and Parker Municipal Code section, and I cite the section. The section I cite is subpart A, which you can find in the exhibit binder as well, and that talks about the taxpayer's right to elect either an informal hearing or formal hearing. So what we were saying is, municipal code purposes, we want the informal hearing, and very clearly, we want the informal hearing that's described in the uniform statute. That's all we ever asked for, is the one informal hearing that's mandated by the uniform statute.
Counsel, can I just draw you back to Justice Coates' questions about your preemption argument? Can you actually direct me to what you're relying on in the Walgreens decision that says that you don't have to obey local procedures while you're contesting them? I mean, typically, and I'm just rephrasing the argument, but typically in a preemption case, the locality says you have to do X. You say, no, we don't have to do X, and you have some procedure to do that. And then there's a declaration. You're right, you didn't have to do X, but you're complying all the way along. And I guess I'm wondering where the authority comes in a preemption context not to comply with the local law before that local law is declared by someone, some judicial officer or someone else, to be inoperative. I mean, where are you getting this that you do not have to follow the law before it has been declared inoperative?
May I grab a copy of
that? Absolutely.
Find it here in a moment. Okay, so in Walgreens, the taxpayer, under the Denver Code, the taxpayer would have been obligated to take its appeal to the district court under 106A4. The taxpayer shunned that. It instead filed the request for review in district court under the uniform statute. So it essentially did what we did. It didn't follow the portions of the municipal code that it determined were in conflict with the uniform statute. At the very end of the decision, it's actually in footnote 19, the court says, we do not conclude that section 5356 and 53124 of the Denver Code are unconstitutional. They are inoperative to the extent that a taxpayer seeks relief pursuant to 29-2-106.1. Extent the taxpayer chooses to follow the uniform statute, the provisions that they chose not to follow are inoperative. I think that's what we're doing here. Again, the cases that I cited previously, the national advertising case, the city of Thornton case, I think speak to the same proposition. And if I might just quote from one of those cases, the city of Thornton case states, we fully recognize in cases of conflict between a statute and the ordinance of a home rule city relating to a matter of statewide concern, the statute must govern. I think that what that's saying is the same principle, is that if there's a conflict, the state statute trumps. The citizen, the taxpayer, is obligated only to follow the primary provision of law, the state law provision.
Thank you.
I would also add that there was a danger here, a real danger. If we had continued to follow what the towns told us we were required to do, that is, ask for the second hearing, wait for the second hearing, present our evidence, and then challenge it, we would have faced a very serious danger that we had lost our appeal rights by not following the uniform statute. Because the uniform statute, again, defines when a taxpayer exhausts local remedies. And it says if you don't get that final decision within 90 days, you've exhausted at that point, and you shall, taxpayer shall file an appeal within 30 days thereafter. So by waiting and participating in these additional town procedures with the intent of challenging them later, we would have exposed ourselves to the argument that we didn't timely file an appeal in accordance with the uniform statute. That could have come from the towns down the road. It could have come from a court on its own initiative. So we were sort of put in a position where we had to choose which path we were going to take.
And just a follow-up, can you help me understand, do we, you started out by saying that the exhaustion issue, I thought what you were going to say is just was not raised or was not part of the cert question, or do we have to reach the exhaustion issue, do you think?
I don't think you do. I think it's within the prerogative of court. It certainly wasn't an issue that was identified in the order granting cert.
Or really addressed by the Court of Appeals?
The Court of Appeals didn't address it either. It was raised by the parties in the briefing of the Court of Appeals, but it wasn't part of the Court of Appeals' decision.
Well, wouldn't it come within the right result, wrong reason?
I think it would. I think the tax, I think the Court has to review it if they want. That's all I have. I might reserve my last 15 seconds. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Ed Gleason, registration number 9744. I'm appearing here on behalf of the towns of Parker and Castle Rock. Very simply stated, the position of the towns in this case is that Richmond did not exhaust its local remedies with the towns. Or if it did do so, it did so in February of 2006, did not file its appeal with the Department of Revenue until May, and thereby missed the 30-day deadline set out to the uniform statute.
Mr. Gleason, that since you've started with a very simple proposition, I guess I would like to understand, one, whether you think that the towns have consistently maintained that position, that is, in their letter that is arguably a final decision, and in their appeal to the Court of Appeals. And if the answer to that certainly is yes, then I also want to know whether you support the decision of the Court of Appeals or whether you instead are agreeing that the decision is wrong.
The answer, Your Honor, is yes to both questions, and we support the decision of the Court of Appeals. To expand on that, the letters, the February 22nd letter that's been talked about from the town attorney to Richmond stated at the end, said very expressly, please be on notice, as far as we're concerned, you have not exhausted your administrative remedies by participating in this settlement meeting. There, you elected a two-step process, we've had step one, now it's time to go to the informal hearing, and if you do not do that, we will take the position that you have failed to exhaust administrative remedies. We then presented the same argument to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals said very expressly that we do not need to reach that question because we think that the Court of Appeals find and conclude that the final decision was rendered in February, the appeal was not filed until May, and therefore on that basis the executive director should be enjoined from proceeding.
But isn't that inconsistent with the argument that that there's been no exhaustion of remedies?
No, I don't believe so at all. Well,
how can you have both a final decision and a failure to exhaust? That's where it seems inconsistent to me.
This letter has to be, understood in proper context. The risk of giving a longer answer than maybe you're asking for, Your Honor, the town code provides the taxpayer with an election. I'm looking at 110A, it's Exhibit 24 in the exhibit notebook. So the taxpayer has an election. And the taxpayer can either go directly to subsection D, which is it's poorly named formal hearing, but what's described in subsection D is the same thing as is described. It's the informal hearing in the uniform statute. The taxpayer can either do that, or if in addition to that, if the taxpayer wishes to precede the hearing with a settlement meeting, the taxpayer can elect that. And 1A
it doesn't call it a settlement hearing, it calls it a hearing, informal hearing.
Right. Yes, but it says informal hearing shall be conducted in any manner acceptable to the taxpayer and the director and with the purpose of settling the outstanding issues between the parties. I'd note also, Your Honor, that in the correspondence, the February 22nd letter and the February 24th letter between the town's council and Mr. Pomerantz, what transpired on February 10th is described by both council as a meeting, as a conference. And so the system set up by the towns and their codes was, we have in place a hearing in subsection D. There is your hearing, the same thing that's described in the uniform statute. There is no difference between what's described in subsection D and what's described as an informal hearing in the uniform statute.
Well, wait a second, Mr. Gleason, I'm having trouble following that, because A says you have a request, you have an election, you have a formal or informal hearing. And then one is what you would see, the C specifically says, seems like it's an informal hearing, and D specifically sets forth a formal hearing. And the statute says there shall be a hearing, one hearing. And it also says it shall be informal. So how do you get to...
A couple of ways, Your Honor. First of all, taking the last point first, the statute does say it shall be informal. If we look at what's described in D, at the hearing, the taxpayer may assert any facts, make any arguments, and file any briefs and affidavit he or she believes pertinent to his or her case. That is the same thing. That is informality. Affidavits are admissible. The rules of evidence don't apply. It says it's elsewhere says it's on the record, but that's not inconsistent with the statute, which says you shall not have a transcript. I acknowledge there's perhaps a close difference there, but you can certainly have proceedings on the record that do not involve a transcript. Towns and cities and appellate courts even do that. And so what's described in subsection D is not inconsistent, we submit, with the uniform statute. Now, the other part of Your Honor's question was, well, how can you have a two-step procedure? The uniform statute plainly says there shall be one hearing. The taxpayer does not have to go to a subsection C hearing. The very first sentence of this hearing section, request for hearing, any taxpayer may request a formal or informal hearing. It's up to the taxpayer. If you don't want to mess around with the settlement conference procedure, you can go straight to hearing. They argue that that's inconsistent with the statute, that under the combination of the uniform statute and Walgreen, that a town may not precede the one hearing with the settlement conference. We disagree.
Wait a minute. Here's my problem. I think I understand your argument. That is that this is really not a hearing. You're calling it a settlement conference. But your code calls it a hearing. And it says you have an election. So I kind of don't see how you get out of the uniform statute.
Well, I think we have to look to the substance, Your Honor, and not the label.
The substance?
The substance of what's provided in subsection C and D and the statute. What's provided in subsection C and what occurred on the ground is reflected in the letters. What actually occurred is the parties got together and had a meeting, and they talked about the issues, and they didn't resolve it.
Well, let me ask you a question I asked Mr. Pomerantz. When were these ordinances enacted?
Yeah.
I believe subsequent to the uniform statute.
But not subsequent to the Walgreen case, presumably?
Well, I'm not sure, Your Honor. Walgreens, I believe, was 1991.
Yes, and clearly, but it seems to me that the appeals process provided in the ordinances is inconsistent with Walgreen. Would you at least concede that?
Yeah, we do concede. We conceded that in the Court of Appeals. We've conceded that all the way along. That's the only provision, though, of these ordinances that are inconsistent with the statute.
Okay, I want to understand that. Go ahead.
I just finish this up. Yeah. So I would assume that these ordinances must predate the Walgreen case. Isn't there a real problem here with how the towns are treating taxpayers by not conforming to the state of the law, and in the letter that was written by the outside counsel says, well, I understand how you could read this and find this confusing, but this isn't what we mean. I mean, what do we do with the fact that these ordinances seem misleading, at least?
Well, I take issue with the premise, respectfully, of course, Your Honor. Certainly, there is a flat-out conflict between the statute and the ordinance insofar as the ordinance says reviews by the 106A4 standard, and the statute says it's de novo. And we've conceded that from day one. We conceded again. We conceded it in the Court of Appeals. Certainly, under the uniform statute in Walgreen, that 106A4 provision is of no effect. The standard's de novo, just like it says in the statute. That's the standard if you get to the appeal to the executive director. Otherwise, except for that, the statute and the ordinance, there is no conflict.
Well, except a terminology conflict, apparently.
Well, one point we've made that's not a big point, I concede, but I think it's worth consideration, is the code say, I think the law says, that labels, titles given to statutes do not control, and ordinances that you look to the substance of what's there. So the labels are not adequately descriptive of what's in the text, but the text, the operative language of these ordinances squares with the statute.
If that's the case, then if I understood it right, they requested an informal hearing citing both the statute and the code. It seems to me that, consistent with the argument that the labels in your code have no significance, why didn't the cities perceive that as a request for an informal hearing pursuant to the statute and a formal hearing pursuant to the code?
What we received, and it's Exhibit 7, we received a couple of answers to that, Your Honor. The letter requesting the hearing was written by counsel for Richmond, dated January 5th, 2006, and it's Exhibit 7. And in the provision that Mr. Pomerantz quoted a few minutes ago, he states, this request is made in accordance with the Uniform Statute and Section 110A of the Code. And 110A in turn says, a taxpayer may request a formal or informal hearing, which requested here, we hereby request an informal hearing. An informal hearing then is described as the two-step process.
Yes, but you've just explained to me that informal hearing doesn't mean informal hearing. I should ignore that terminology. Informal hearing means some sort of settlement or mediation, and that formal hearing is an informal hearing. And so therefore, it seems to me, I understand what the letter says, that's been read to me twice now, but it seems to me that, consistent with your description of the codes, the towns would perceive that request as for an informal hearing pursuant to the statute, and although it states an informal hearing is elected pursuant to the code, the towns should read that as a formal hearing is requested pursuant to the code, because it's the formal hearing that is an informal hearing, according to your argument.
Well, but part of the reason I would take issue with that characterization of what transpired is the ensuing correspondence, which is in the exhibits, the following exhibits between exhibits 8 and 13. And what happened then, for example, shortly following this request, in subsection C, the settlement conference in substance provision, it says that has to happen within 30 days. Council exchanged letters saying, is it okay if we go beyond the 30-day period? Could we waive it and not have the subsection 3 settlement conference within 30 days? There's no reason for council to be having that discussion unless
C&D. There's maybe no reason for the town to be having that discussion, but there's every reason for MDC to be having that discussion, because your nomenclature has arguably given them the impression that the informal hearing pursuant to the code is the informal hearing pursuant to the statute. Now, I don't know why they would think that, but it might be reasonable, do you not think, to accept the label, even though ultimately it's not controlling?
Yes, I mean, part of the problem here is the exhaustion requirements, and MDC having taken it upon themselves to determine that there's a conflict of preemption present here. This court's decisions say that it's not up to the taxpayer to say, I hereby declare that there's preemption and therefore I'm not going to complete your process. This court's decisions say over and over again, the United Airlines decision, the Crow versus Penrose St. Francis Hospital decision, that was a doctor, Dr. Crow, who said there was a five-step procedure there, and it involved a disciplinary suspension proceedings. And Dr. Crow said, I don't think I should have to do that. I think there's due process violations. I think it affects my fundamental rights. I think you're misconstruing your regulations. There's lots of reasons I should not have to go through this. And what this court held in Crow is no, under very well-established principles of administrative law, and for, quoting the words of this court, strong policy reasons, which the court enumerated, four or five of them, that if you think you have a preemption argument, if you think the labels are bad, if you think there's a conflict with the uniform statute, you have to write it out for reasons explained in Crow and United Airlines. You have to complete the process. And then when you're done with the, or you also have the option under Fred Schmidt of going to court midway through the process and seeking injunctive relief and asking a court to say, I think this is all messed up. I think the labels are backwards. I can't make sense of this. I shouldn't have to follow it. You can go to court and do that, or you can complete the process as prescribed in the agency's ordinances.
Okay.
And then raise that issue.
I appreciate that. We can talk about some more, and I'm sure there may be some other questions about how we reconcile that and Walgreens and so forth, and we heard an argument. But I would actually like for you to, I think you maybe lost sight of my question that you began to answer in a sort of a roundabout way, and I would like to have the opportunity to answer that question, which was, isn't your exhaustion argument inconsistent with the position that a final decision was rendered? How can you have had no request for a informal hearing pursuant to the statute and a formal hearing pursuant to the code, and no formal hearing, and therefore no exhaustion, and no final decision, yet the letter is still a final decision in some way?
Our position, Your Honor, is that the letter became final when the taxpayer declined to complete the process. That the letter was issued at halftime. Okay, there's and I think the letter reflects that. That the letter, in the mind of the town, the letter is being issued at halftime, and it says, we had our meeting, we're not persuaded, our position remains as stated in our final denial in December, and it was...
Okay, well, if that's the case, doesn't that exhaust the remedies? If the halftime decision can become a final decision, why isn't that exhaustion?
Well, the reason it's not exhaustion is because exhaustion under this court's precedence says you have to complete the process in the codes, whether you agree with it or not, whether you have a challenge or not, whether you...
I'm sorry, I just still don't get it. And if you haven't completed the process in the code, how do you have a final decision?
Well, I think there's two ways of looking at it. I think there's alternative ways of looking at this. Either one leads to affirmance of the judgment of the Court of Appeals.
I appreciate that the Court of Appeals has found an argument that I don't think you ever made to resolve the case and that it's in your favor. But it also seems to me that the argument that you are making and have always made, with the possible exception of responding to the request for a hearing, is inconsistent with that opinion. And I just don't see how the town can have it both ways. There's a final decision and a failure to exhaust.
Your Honor, if I could maybe direct the court to one of the exhibits that we had is exhibit 21. That's a letter that I actually wrote to the person with the Colorado Department of Revenue, setting out, I tried to fairly succinctly, the positions of the towns.
And I'm sorry, is it attached to something, or?
It's an exhibit that should be part of the...
I'm sure it may be part of the record, but was it attached to any of the briefing?
No, it was not.
Okay.
No, it was not. And I'd simply point out there, Your Honor, that the argument that I'm making now is really set out there. The position we articulated to the executive director is we said that to be entitled to an appeal, the taxpayer must have exhausted its local remedies. Richmond did not request a formal hearing. Accordingly, it did not exhaust its local remedies. And then I went on to say they may argue that they did exhaust. If so, then they did so in February. They didn't file their appeal till May. That's more than 30 days. So either way, Richmond loses in terms of jurisdiction of the executive director. So that is a position that we have articulated all the way along. We articulated that to the district court, to the Court of Appeals, and we similarly view it in this court. And the Court of Appeals, Your Honor, did address it that way. I mean, the Court of Appeals said we don't need to decide whether there was exhaustion. In fact, they broke that down into three issues. They had kind of a two-part exhaustion issue, as I recall. They said we don't need to decide issues one and two because we can resolve this case on issue three, which is assuming they're right, assuming there was exhaustion, assuming they did everything they had to do as of February, they got a final decision in February that the exhaustion of local remedies is actually defined in the uniform statute. It has three elements: request for a hearing, hearing, and final decision. The issue, of course, and that's the Supreme Court, or this court, granted cert on that issue, is whether the February 22nd letter from the town's attorney constituted a final decision or not. And so that's what the procedural history has been, and those are the arguments and positions and resolutions of the court. Maybe going to that question, because it does get to the heart of this, at least our position, just so it's clear, is there was not exhaustion here. And that the codes, the town codes, plainly required further process. The town attorney in the February 22nd letter said exhaustion has not happened yet. You've got another step to take. On the ground, kind of in the real world, what actually happened, they'd had one meeting. This is a use tax dispute involving hundreds of homes, and there's one meeting. And that's what this court's being asked to be, potentially, depending on how the court resolves it, to say constitutes an exhaustion of local remedies. And so we say, number one, there was no exhaustion, that exhaustion did not happen, and you can, an exhaustion cannot be satisfied by saying, I did everything that I think I should have to do. You've got some other stuff I don't think I should have to do. You've got some things that I think are preempted by state statutes. I don't have to do those. I'm exhausted. It doesn't work that way. Crow says you can't do, Crow in particular says you cannot do that. United Airlines says you cannot do that. To exhaust, you have to go through the process or challenge the process midway.
Can I stop you there? So how do you read footnote 19 in the Walgreens opinion?
In Walgreens, Your Honor, and I'm turning to footnote 19, my understanding is in Walgreens, the taxpayer completed the process. Now, let me, if I may. I don't think, I'm looking at footnote 19 now, Your Honor, and I don't read that as being inconsistent with the holdings of this court in Crow and in United Airlines, the subsequent holdings, that even if you disagree with the administrative process, that you have to complete the process before challenging it in order to exhaust remedies. And the in Walgreens, in section, on the first page of the opinion, section Roman 1, Walgreen challenged the assessment and requested a hearing before the revenue manager. A hearing was held. The revenue manager affirmed the original assessment. Walgreen appealed to the district court. So Walgreen went through the process.
Well, did Walgreen, though, go through the inoperative local procedures?
I think the problem in Walgreen was that the Denver ordinance said, and I think Denver was arguing that as a home rule city, we're not bound by the statute. I think that was among the arguments that Denver unsuccessfully made. And so Denver in its ordinance said, we know about the statute, but that doesn't apply here in Denver. And therefore, the standard of review is going to be a 106A4 statute and not de novo. And this court in the Walgreen case said wrong. Even home rule cities are bound by the statute for the reasons expressed in Walgreen. And therefore, the Denver is mistaken in its contention that it's a 106A4 standard. It's a de novo statute, just like the standard, just like the statute says.
So Denver, go back and do it again, essentially.
I believe, although I'm not certain of that, to be honest. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
On the exhaustion, I think I said what I have to say about that.
You said that, and I want to pursue what the Chief Justice opened up, I thought, and that was you made a concession here that the Rule 106A4 procedure doesn't apply, correct?
Correct.
Okay, but the problem is that counsel here is trying to protect their clients' ability to pursue under the uniform statute the two provisions just above, which the Chief Justice alluded to, say formal hearing and on the record, and, you know, then when you read the 106 box, I'm going to call it a box, that the code seems to be forcing the taxpayer into, why is it perfectly reasonable that that, together, to any reasonable attorney trying to go with the uniform statute is seeing that the town is trying to force them into a 106A4 that is clearly preempted? So when you look at the informal hearing nomenclature, the formal hearing, isn't it perfectly rational, and maybe the break ought to go to the taxpayer in view of the uniform statute and our case law, that they did exactly what they needed to do to protect their client's interests? In the face of the fact that we have counsel interchange here, not a decision by the decision maker. At any time that I see, the town of Parker or Castle Rock had the decision maker actually make a decision.
Well, the towns were not trying to force the taxpayer into any sort of box here.
No, I'm saying the code does that. The code does that. That's what the code is doing. You can't just blithely, to me, concede that 106A4 is not right when 106A4 in the code is tied to this formal hearing on the record to get a standard of review that is different than the de novo standard in the uniform statute.
Well, that's the part where I see it differently, Your Honor.
Okay.
I don't see the 106A4, the provision for what happens on an appeal of the process at the town, as driving what that process is going to be, what it's going to consist of. We can just look at the section, subsection D, and it says at the hearing, the taxpayer may assert any facts, make any arguments, file briefs, file affidavits, the same thing that's described in the uniform statute. So the taxpayer here, and the letters, quite clearly set out the town's, the February 22nd letters, quite clearly set out the town's position that you have elected, you've chosen to have a settlement conference and the hearing process described in subsection D, and having made that election, you got to do both.
Mr. Pomerantz argues that he had a real dilemma, because if he sat on his rights and didn't file for an appeal under the statute within whatever the statutory 30 days or whatever it is, or 90 days, I guess it is, if no answer, that then you'd be able to come in and get his appeal dismissed on the grounds that he'd let too much time go by.
Well, the statute's quite clear that the 30 days runs from exhaustion of local remedies. And
I was talking about in the situation, isn't it, if you wait 90 days without getting an answer, then you can file the appeal?
Well, the statute, Your Honor, says that exhaustion of local remedies means that the 90-day provision applies if the hearing's held and no decision is issued.
Mm-hmm.
Had the taxpayer followed the code and said, we're going to do what the code says, and we're going to request a hearing, and then the hearing's held, and then a decision's issued on that hearing, that there is a decision. There's the 90-day, stated otherwise, the 90-day period would not begin, that Mr. Pomerantz is concerned about, would not begin to run until after the hearing takes place. If a hearing on the record is provided in subsection D takes place, there is no argument. There's no argument that that's not a hearing that isn't implicated and trigger the various timelines in the statute.
Well, so you're just saying that his argument is illusory, that he ran the risk, under his theory, the ordinance called the informal hearing. He had gone through that, and he was not running any real risk of letting more than 90 days go by with no decision from that.
Right, and furthermore, there are recognized exceptions to the exhaustion doctrine, and that's not on the list. It's not been argued that that's on the list. And in fact, it was either Crow or United Airlines, but the this court was invited to add to the list, to add another exception if the person appearing before the agency professes confusion or has a challenge, or a viable challenge to the process in question or whatever. And this court said no.
Well, Mr. Gleason, in United Airlines, it was very clear that the failure to follow the administrative remedy or process was an appeal in the assessment. And instead, United went around and tried to do the refund procedure, which had a longer time period. But it was both internal city procedures. So it's really a different situation. And here we have potential a conflict between a state statute and your code.
I think the case is much closer to this case as well. I agree to that extent. United Airlines articulates principles that are relevant here.
Well, the theory is one thing, but it's how you apply it.
In the Crow decision, I think that's, I don't know how you distinguish that from this case. Dr. Crow said, for a variety of reasons, I shouldn't have to comply with that process. That's wrong. It even violates due process. And this court said, no, you have to see the process through and challenge it. And I think that's the same situation we have here. If the court looks at some of the rationale, some of the implications, Crow said, well, among the reasons we have that is if we do otherwise, we're going to riddle the statute. If there was a statute there, too.
No, medical
malpractice. We'll riddle it with exceptions. So we've got to follow the rules. Thank you very much.
I'd like to see if I can make two quick points in 8 seconds. Mr. Gleason directed the court to Exhibit 21 as evidence that the towns have taken a consistent position throughout these proceedings. I'd really invite the court to take a look at 21. Mr. Gleason himself says in that letter, on February 10, 2006, Castle Rock and Parker each held an informal hearing of a denial of Richmond's use tax refund request. So he's saying in that letter that it was, in fact, an informal hearing. And you'll see in some of the lower court briefing that that's the position the towns took, is that there was an informal hearing. The notion that it was only a settlement conference is a relatively new formulation. Last point I'd like to make is on the exhaustion issue. United Airlines involved a situation where the municipal code provisions were, there was nothing unlawful about them. There was no claim that they were unlawful. The taxpayer just chose not to follow them. And the court said in that case that the taxpayer is bound to follow the local procedures when they are, quote, consistent with the agency's governing statutes. What we have here is exactly the opposite situation. We've got municipal procedures that are in conflict with the governing statute, which is the uniform statute.
Thank you. I think your time has expired.
Thank you.
On behalf of the court, I thank the counsel for your arguments. The case will stand submitted.